Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Like it or not, for millions of Americans, this New Year's weekend means television, college bowls, NFL playoffs, a new Simpsons. Michelle Obama's on Iron Chef this Sunday. But if a network is fighting with your cable provider, you might be stuck watching reruns. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's 2010. It's the first of the year. Happy New Year, and thanks for joining us on this Friday. News Corporation and Time Warner Cable, they are still duking it out today. News Corp, of course, owns the Fox Network and other channels, and it's trying to charge Time Warner more money to carry its signals. And it's not just those two battling over subscription fees. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the whole television business is changing, and everybody wants to set the rules.
This was on Channel 5 in Manhattan this afternoon.
Another crazy day.
Which means another TMZ Live.
Unremarkable, except that Fox had threatened to pull shows like TMZ from Time Warner Cable today. Instead, the two sides agreed to keep talking after their contract expired at midnight. Paul Gallant is an analyst with Concept Capital. He says as advertising revenue dries up, broadcasters like Fox are looking to cable fees.
The model of advertising-supported local TV is getting really challenged in the marketplace. And so TV stations are saying, look, what we need is a second revenue stream besides advertising.
It's not just Fox and Time Warner digging in their heels. Cablevision said today it will no longer carry the Food Network and HGTV in the New York area. That after their owner Scripps Networks demanded higher fees. Robert Thompson is a professor of television and popular culture at Syracuse University. He says the usual year-end contract disputes have taken on new urgency as the television business model changes.
I think it's the same reason we saw the intensity of the last writer's strike. Everybody wants to make sure, as this equation gets redefined, that they are in a beneficial position with that new equation.
Thompson says it's viewers who will lose out. When the dust finally settles, he says it's almost a given they'll pay more for television. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Football fans in parts of the Midwest and Southeast can relax. Sinclair Broadcasting Group says it's reached a temporary deal with cable provider Mediacom. They will extend their contract for 8 days, so football fans won't miss Georgia Tech and Iowa playing in the Orange Bowl. Keeping illegal immigrants in jail is expensive. It's one reason Arizona's budget is a mess. So the state is sending some of its detainees to the feds. Arizona has been transferring illegal immigrants from state to federal prisons to serve the final months of their sentences, thus sticking the federal taxpayer with the bill. Starting today, Arizona's governor is stepping up the program, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Each month, Arizona transfers 200 nonviolent criminal immigrants from state prison to federal custody. Paul Sensman is spokesman for Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. He says the state will send the feds up to 1,200 more inmates in the next year and a half.
The preliminary estimates are it could save as much as $2 million just in this fiscal year alone, possibly $3.5 million or more in the next fiscal year.
Other states are trying different approaches. In California, Governor Schwarzenegger may commute the sentences of some illegal immigrants and deport them. Deporting 600 inmates could save California about $15 million. But some wonder if the feds have adequate funding to handle a flood of new detainees. Mark Krikorian is executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors tighter immigration controls. He says Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has released inmates in the past due to a lack of resources.
They're going to be in a real pickle because they're going to have more deportable aliens that they need to detain than they have space for.
If it needs more money, ICE will have to get in line. At least a dozen governors complain that the federal government doesn't properly reimburse states for the cost of detaining illegal immigrants. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, how do you turn a 3,000% profit on one stock? It helps to know your worsted wool from your Harris tweed. I'll tell you that story when we do the numbers. I told you a lot of stories in 2009 about people trying to make money or give away money, or especially this year, trying not to lose all their money. Behind all these stories is a question. Does money make you happy? Our next guest has been studying the subject. Gretchen Rubin's new book is called The Happiness Project. Gretchen, welcome to the program.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here.
How did The Happiness Project begin for you?
You know, it started while I was stuck on a bus. I was riding a crosstown bus on a rainy afternoon. So I had a rare moment of reflection, and I thought, what do I want from life anyway? And I thought, well, I want to be happy. And I realized for the first time that I never thought about whether I was happy or what it meant to be happy or how I could be happier. And I thought, wow, I should have a happiness project.
So what is one concrete project you started for yourself to make yourself happier?
I needed a way to do something novel and challenging for myself, so I decided I would start a blog because I was terrified by that. I had no idea what I was doing, so I thought, well, that'll be something good that would be novel and challenging. And my blog has turned into this gigantic engine of happiness for me. One of the funny people mentioned this over and over when I ask people, of all the resolutions that you've tried that I've suggested, what has really worked? People say to me, make my bed. It's so simple, but I can't even tell you how many people have said that this was something that helped them really get going on their happiness project.
You know, Gretchen, I'm guessing you have friends who've been out of work this year.
I sure do.
What do they tell you about your happiness project?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes I worry that the kind of things I talk about will seem trivial to someone who's facing a big happiness challenge. But I think that for some people, it really does help to try to take steps along the way while they're handling something like being out of work, which is certainly one of the most major happiness challenges that people do face.
You write that work is critical to happiness.
It is, partly because it's just a big part of our time. I mean, we spend a lot of time at work. So if you're not happy at work, it's hard to be happy with your life. And also, work is a place where we find many of the things that bring us happiness, things like a sense of purpose and a sense of connection with other people, a way to earn money, which is important for happiness, too. So work is a very important part of happiness.
Have you found that money buys happiness?
A lot of it, whether money brings you happiness, has to do with how you are making choices with your money. And so part of it is, are you buying things that are going to bring you more happiness? For example, one of the keys to happiness, sort of everyone agrees, it's strong relationships with other people. So if you're using your money to strengthen your relationships with other people, like buying a plane ticket to go visit your sister or buying pizza and beer to have your friends over for a New Year's Eve party, something like that, then that is something that's going to tend to make you happier.
So, okay, you're talking to an unemployed friend who says, look, I know the key to my happiness. It's a J-O-B.
Yes.
So what do you tell them meantime they can do?
Well, first of all, I would say make sure you get enough sleep. So that's the first thing. Also, to exercise. Exercise will help you sleep better, it turns out, and also fall asleep faster. But it also boosts your mood. It calms you. It energizes you. Another thing is people who are out of work often just feel this urge to isolate themselves. But connecting with other people is a great way to boost your mood. It's also important if you're trying to get out there and get a job, is the more connections that you have, the more you're going to be part of the stream of things. So another important thing is to just stick to your plans, make plans, show up, even if it's the last thing that you feel like doing.
Gretchen Rubin is the author of The Happiness Project. Gretchen, thanks a lot. Happy New Year.
Oh, Happy New Year to you.
Here is a word we heard a lot at the beginning of 2009, fun employment. Remember that? You make the most of your layoff by enjoying your free time to the hilt. Somehow the fun seemed to wear off as the recession ground on. But back in April, reporter Julie Rose of member station WFAE in Charlotte found some folks who could afford to enjoy their misfortune.
The subject line of the email read, "Laid off," all caps, 2 exclamation points. It was from my friend, Jenny Vanstone, an interior designer. I felt terrible thinking of her down in the unemployment line. But a few weeks later, I started getting emails from her that were like, "Hey, can't right now, off to meet a friend for coffee," or "Headed to the park, we'll talk later."
As long as I get my resumes out, I make a little bit of an effort to look for work. Gosh, it's a great feeling. It is like being on vacation some days. Like, what do I want to do today?
Tell you what I'd like to do is get home from work just once this week before the sun sets. And I know this sounds awful, but I'm jealous of Jenny. She's doing more yoga, taking road trips, and her social life is booming.
I can stay out later at night because I can take a nap the next day if I am worn out. Now I have flexibility.
You could say flexibility and freedom are the upside of being laid off, if there is an upside. But the unemployment grass isn't always as green as it seems. I meet Yaqui Benson at an after-hours mixer for people who've been pink-slipped. She's been out of work for 2 months.
I do take time out and go to the movies. I'll go volunteer. I'll go and visit with friends. It keeps me from focusing so hard on the fact that I don't have a job, because it can be depressing.
Nonprofits say they're getting lots of calls from unemployed people with extra time on their hands. Jeff Steiner started volunteering too, since he was laid off from a Charlotte law firm in August. He says he is not treating unemployment like a party, but he knows people who are.
People who haven't done a thing, literally since August, that will go out drinking 7 nights a week till 2 a.m. every night. You know, I mean, it's dull.
Maybe he's not out drinking every night, but Jeff's also not exactly hurting. With a nice severance package, he has the luxury of taking a little time to decide what comes next.
You know, getting a job at a large top 50 law firm these days, absolute disaster. So you got to use this time to either reinvent your career path, or you can say, all right, let me tread water doing something that I hate and hope that in 2 years there's a position waiting for me.
That's how Jenny is taking things too, especially since interior design jobs are hard to come by.
It's about not jumping onto the first thing available. It's about finding the right thing for me. I definitely feel like there's been a huge silver lining, and I'm looking at it as an opportunity. More than a crisis.
Jenny's fortunate that losing her job didn't plunge her into immediate crisis, and she knows it. But she's going on 4 months without work now. The unemployment checks will soon stop coming, and her savings will eventually run out. So she's given me permission to envy her free time, as long as I remember that it comes with a price. I'm Julie Rose for Marketplace.
And some updates on the people we just met. Jenny Vanstone took a part-time job this summer teaching design at a college. She is looking for another part-time job for when her unemployment benefits run out in a few weeks. Jeff Steiner moved back to D.C. and got a job as an attorney advisor for a government agency. And Yaqui Benson did some temp work at Bank of America and got hired on permanently. So all three of them begin the new year employed. Coming up, being a world-class runner, it's not a recreation.
It's something difficult. You have to work for it. Running a marathon is not running for fun. You have to be running for money.
But first, let's do a New Year's Day edition of the numbers. Major markets are closed today, a good chance to take stock. In this decade, the Brits call the noughties. The Dow lost 9%, NASDAQ down 44%. The S&P 500 was off 24%. General Electric fizzled 70% in the decade. Then there's Apple, up 720%. The outfitter Joseph A. Bank Clothiers started 2000 just over a dollar a share and closed at nearly $41 yesterday. That's just a 3,196% gain. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. How will climate change affect where you live? Go to marketplace.org/climate and click on the map. You'll also find dramatic photos of the impact of climate change from around the world, plus all the stories from our series, The Climate Race.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up this Monday. The Burj Dubai, the tallest man-made structure in history, officially opens its doors for occupancy. New shipping rates for the U.S. Postal Service, FedEx, and UPS go into effect. And 145 years ago today, the New York Stock Exchange opened its first permanent headquarters just a few blocks from Wall Street. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl. The beautiful thing about New Year's Day is that sense of renewal, a fresh start. But this year, thanks to the recession, a lot of us have already made a new start, whether we wanted to or not. Commentator Peter Bash is one of those people who recently found himself at the bottom of a long climb.
For 36 years, I had steady work, flying around the country doing presentations for investment banks. It was cozy and seemed so secure. Until it ended last year. Now I'm looking for what else I can do. This is a scary time, especially since my family has a grim tradition of starting over in your 50s with mixed results. My grandfather, Felix, was a Jewish filmmaker in Germany. He directed and acted in over 70 movies. When Hitler rose to power, Felix took his family to the United States. But Hollywood was full of German emigres who knew how to wear a monocle, so Felix did smaller and smaller parts until 1944. That year he died. He was only 56 years old. 5 years after that, my father began a successful career as a glamour photographer. For the next 25 years, he took hundreds of thousands of pictures of every actress, starlet, dancer, and model. His pictures paid for my private school and my mom's fur coats. But in 1972, when he was 51, that industry changed. Dad did a pictorial for Playboy, The Girls of Scandinavia. When he came back with hundreds of beautiful pictures, the new photo editor turned them down, saying they weren't raunchy enough. My father, shocked and angry, locked up his cameras, and he never took another picture except for family snapshots. He had to keep working, so he started a one-man literary agency. He only had a few clients, but he could support himself and my mom. I was out of college, and mom could wear fake fur. Now I'm 53, and it's my turn. I don't want to be like poor Felix, so talented but so stubborn. I'd rather learn from my father, be creative, and adjust to a changing market. I've been playing with computers since the 80s, optimizing, fixing. My wife, Ellen, finally told me, you know, my friends are all envious that I have a resident nerd. Maybe some of them will hire you. Well, one just did. Bash Tech has its first customer, and more are on the way, so I'm trying to be flexible, imaginative, and patient. Grandpa, Dad, and Ellen, thanks for the lessons.
Peter Bash is a computer consultant in Los Angeles. Yes, his company is still in business. To tell us your story about starting over, just go to our website, marketplace.org. The sport of marathoning has exploded in the last 20 years. The number of runners has just about doubled. For most of them, a marathon is recreation. It's a challenge, maybe even a New Year's resolution. For other people, a marathon, it's a job. This summer in our series, Working, we took you to Kenya, a country that, along with Ethiopia, dominates the marathoning world. Since 1990, Kenyan men have won all but three Boston marathons. Kenyan women have won 7 of the last 10. Reporter John Miller went to meet the most recent female winner.
I think the best way to introduce you to Selena Kozgei is to play you a condensed version of the last quarter mile of the 2009 Boston Marathon.
Kara just lost the lead. Amazing.
The big story was Kara Goucher from Oregon. The last time an American won Boston was 1985. Goucher entered the stretch drive shoulder to shoulder with last year's winner, an Ethiopian named Dire Tune. Everyone was focused on those two.
Dire Tune looking brilliant at this point, our defending champion from Ethiopia in the front. But Kara's coming back! Kara's coming back!
But chugging away a step or two behind was a dark, thin woman who just refused to go away.
Here comes Koska!
Now it's Koska!
Selena Koska, the winner of the Boston Marathon.
Oh, Tune's gone. Tune collapses at the finish.
The closest finish in women's Boston Marathon history.
In a race that took more than 2.5 hours, the margin of victory was less than a second. A few weeks later, I traveled to Western Kenya to meet Selena Kozgei. That's the way you pronounce it. It turns out she's made a career of coming from behind. For years, she raced internationally as a sprinter. When she started slowing down, she switched to the 10,000 meters, but she struggled. So in her late 20s, she tried the marathon for the first time. Now she's 32. This was her first really big win.
So you know the image of there's a rainbow and there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah.
Well, you found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. That must change your life.
Yeah, it changed. It was 1 second, but it changed my life. I feel like I'm somebody else, different.
Different and not so different.
We are going to a place where, when it is raining, we normally train there.
The worst thing a runner can do is break routine, so an hour after I got there, we went for a run. I mean, Selena went for a run. I rode alongside her in the car and asked questions.
I mean, do you get up in the morning saying, I can't wait to go out for my run today, or is it something you have to do?
It's something you have to do because it is a job. You have to do it every day.
Actually, she trains 3 times a day, 3 days a week, and twice the other 4 days. Sometimes long runs, sometimes weight training, sometimes speed work. All for just 2 marathons a year. That's as many as her body can handle.
Do you love this? Or
yeah, I love this.
When you train, are you in pain?
Yeah, of course. You have to be in pain.
No pain, no gain, they say.
Yeah, no pain, no gain. It's normal.
Here it's normal. This part of Kenya is thick with runners, Olympic medalists, world record holders. You can see them on the red dirt roads, running together in packs. The climate here is perfect for running, and so is the altitude, about 8,000 feet. And there are training camps now, some owned by foreigners, where runners can focus on getting better. But if you spend time here, you find that the real secret to the Kenyan success is that they work so hard and they want it so much. Selena Kozgei grew up in a mud hut, the 10th child of a family of subsistence farmers. There was no plumbing or electricity. She got her first shoes at age 14. She knew early on that running was a way to lift herself up. Around here, the nicest houses, the biggest cars, all belong to runners.
You know, when you talk to American runners, it's about the psychology of it. It's about overcoming the difficulties. It's not about money.
But it is the same with them because they also go for money. If they don't win, they are not saying it's fun. It's something difficult. You have to work for it. Running a marathon is not running for fun. You have to be running for money.
You or I have to pay to enter a marathon. Because Selena is an elite runner, race organizers pay her an appearance fee, provided she finishes under a certain time. In Boston, her fee was $30,000. Adidas, her sponsor, pays her $30,000 a year to wear their clothes when she races. So just by doing okay, Selena can make a decent living. The big money comes when she wins. When she won Boston, she got $200,000 in prize money and bonuses. That's a big payday in a country where the average income is less than $400 a year. But Selena knows it won't last forever. She figures she's got 3 or 4 more years of running left, so she's careful about her spending. Instead of buying a trampoline, she runs in place on this old truck tire. She keeps cows and chickens to cut down on food costs. She eats what she's always eaten, cornmeal mush with small portions of meat and vegetables. She drives a second-hand Toyota RAV4 that she bought from another Boston Marathon champ. And she's holding on to her $300 a month job with the provincial prison system. She used to be a guard. Now she works in the personnel office when she's not training, which is pretty rare. Her boss, Julius Adero, says he's happy to cut her some slack. Almost all Kenyan runners have government jobs.
We are aware of what athletics has done to our country. It has put our country in the map. And it's government policy to support such international athletes to the hilt.
Selena has become something of a celebrity in Kenya. There was a parade for her when she got back from Boston. Her picture was in all the papers. Everywhere she goes, people congratulate her. But when I got there, she still hadn't been home to see her mother. So she and her husband, Barnabas Kinyor, a former world-class hurdler, drove out for a quick visit. The farm is miles from anywhere, in a rolling green patchwork of cornfields and gardens. When we arrived, we found that Selena's mother and sisters and cousins had made a huge meal for us. Selena paid for this house about 10 years ago. It's made of rough wooden boards with a tin roof. She's offered to build a better one, but her mom says she's fine with what she's got. She's just happy Selena's doing well. When we finished eating, the whole extended family gathered in the dirt yard to sing us a song of welcome. Marathons are brutal on the body and on family life. Selena's got two kids, aged 9 and 13. They live 3 hours from where she trains. So does her husband. She hardly sees them. When she quits, she says she might just go back to her job at the prison. That way the family could live together. But what she'd really like to do is open a camp for aspiring young runners to help them do what she did. Money is great, she says, but in the long run, she'd rather make history.
John Miller went to Kenya to get that story for us. Our series Working is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can hear all the profiles in our Working series and see photos when you visit our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, a Michigan university is out with its annual New Year's Day list of words and phrases that ought to be buried along with the old year. Shovel ready is on there, as in shovel ready stimulus programs. Stimulus is also on the list. Toxic assets, too big to fail, transparency, czar, tweet, app. I'm afraid if we dropped all those expressions in 2010, we wouldn't have a show. But we do, and it's Marketplace from American Public Media. The domestic markets were closed for the New Year's holiday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, charity is more appealing when there's a personal connection. But what's appealing isn't always best for the recipient.
The help they're getting is dependent on the whim of the donor, not on what they really need.
I'm Bill Radke. Kai's back on Monday. Happy New Year, and have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.